Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com. And as I said at the top of the show, sometimes we have special guests on this program, and sometimes we have very special guests on this program, but tonight it goes beyond that language. The adjective doesn't even exist to say how special and exciting this is for me. This is one of my musical idols and influences growing up. He has been in the music business for 4 decades, maybe more. Well, there isn't anything else I can say except welcome to the neighborhood, Tom Paxton.
Thank you very much, Dave, and hello to all my friends on Long Island.
Yeah, well, you were on Long Island for a while. I mean,
27 years.
And why did you move to Virginia? Why did you leave us?
Huh?
Why?
We came down here to be closer to our daughter Jennifer and grandson, and now we have 3 grandsons.
Mazel tov, mazel tov.
And then I also tell people that we lived in East Hampton until my car got too old and they made us move.
And do you like Virginia, or is it not quite long? How is it where you are now?
Oh, it's wonderful. We live right down by the Potomac in Old Town, Alexandria, Virginia.
Wow. And you travel still. I mean, you tour a whole lot. How much out of the year are you traveling and singing and touring, and how much is just, living at home?
I've cut it way down from the days when I had kids in college. So I don't travel as much as I used to, although you look at the schedule and you say, where's the cut down here? But it just doesn't feel like I'm working that often anymore.
Or at least not touring that often. I mean, you're not only singer-songwriter, but you've got books out now and children's books.
Yeah, I'm not currently working on any book. I'm writing songs right now, trying to get the next record ready to go in the studio.
Is that also going to be on Appleseed?
Appleseed, yes, it will be.
They released your last album, which is already about 2 or 3 years old. You're losing a little steam, dude. Not as prolific as you used to be.
No.
But does that matter to you, or is it you just make the songs come when they do?
I'd like to be writing more than I'm writing, but we just moved houses, and I'm here to tell you that that's a time suck if ever there were one. I mean, it's been like 6 straight weeks of packing boxes and unpacking boxes.
As you moved within Virginia, it's not like you just moved from the island. You
changed one house. We only moved about 8 or 9 blocks, but you might as well be moving to Tucson. I mean, everything has to be packed up and shipped, and it just takes a little shorter time to get to the new house. That's all.
Did you, in going through all this stuff that you're packing up, come across amazing memorabilia that got you thinking about things, or stuff you haven't seen?
No, I know where that stuff is. All that stuff's in a file cabinet. It's all my notebooks going back to 1960.
Wow. And what college is
it? Now and then I look through them and shake my head at all the terrible songs, and then now and then there'll be a good one, that's just kind of the way I've always worked. I've written a lot, thrown away a lot, and kept a couple.
Let me ask you, how can you tell a wretched song from a good one? It's probably a pretty fine line, or is it not?
I don't think it's that fine a line, Dave. I think I can usually tell before I'm even finished with a song that I've got something on the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when I finish the first draft of a lyric and start messing around with a tune and start changing words, then I know that I'm working on what will be at least a good song, if not a better song.
And how do you know also when you're finished? Because you've written, literally, you have written classics. I mean, not every famous songwriter can say that, but you have written probably more than a dozen folk and pop classic songs. How do you know when they're extra special, or don't you, the audience tells you?
Audience tells me. Because I've written some songs that I thought were extra special, and they didn't get anything like that kind of reaction. So usually the audience tells me, and very quickly, if something has moved them, they'll tell me that right away. I think the best reaction I get is when I'm from my fellow performers and singers when they say, really good one.
Mm-hmm.
That means a lot to me because they're writers as well.
Right.
But I never sing a song that I don't think is good. Um, so so an audience couldn't really tell me that something was good that I didn't think was good, because I wouldn't have sung it in the first place. I tell young performers that a great way of putting together a repertoire of songs to perform, and by the way, they really shouldn't be just their own songs, is to remember it. There are three ways of choosing songs. I mean, you can sing a song that you love and the audience hates, and that's kind of dumb.
Right.
Or you can sing a song that the audience loves and you hate, which is also dumb because it'll turn you into a hack. Or you can find songs that you and the audience agree on and make that the basis of your repertoire.
Well, but that also, again, it leads to a question that I'm a little curious about. Like, I know, or I assume, that no matter what, any concert that you do, at some point you've got to sing The Last Thing on My Mind. Because everybody loves it. It's a wonderful, beautiful song. But do you ever just go up there in your head and go, I want to sing another one of mine that's just as good, if only these people would let me, but I know I've got to sing Last Thing on My Mind?
Oh, no. No, I don't feel that way about... I still love to sing the song. There's something special about the song, and I still like to do it, and I know that the audience not only wants to hear it, but expect to hear it, and they have every right to hear it. I don't believe, luckily, the songs that they really want to hear are songs that I still like to do, so it's not a problem.
Yeah.
I'm just glad that I'm not the one who had the hit with the Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, you know, because people would be expecting to hear that.
Right.
That would be a little tough to do. But I think there are four or five songs, no more than that, four or five songs that the audience is absolutely want to hear and expect to hear and are going to hear.
Ramblin' Boy, what else?
Yeah, Ramblin' Bottle of Wine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Going to the zoo or...
Yeah, well, I don't do the zoo except in children's shows now.
Right.
But those songs belong in the show, and they'll be in the show as long as I'm performing. And the deal is, it's kind of an unspoken agreement, you know. If I'll be sure to sing those four or five songs, they kind of let me choose the rest of the stuff I'll do, you know.
It's a fair deal. That's a, you know.
Yeah, it's a fair exchange. And but I'm very careful to always include those songs.
I think at one point on one of your live albums, you mentioned that your first song was The Marvelous Toy when you were working as a clerk typist for the Army. Am I wrong about that, or was Marvelous Toy your first real song?
Close. It was my first good song.
Ah, do you remember?
It's been about the 50th song I wrote, and of course I thought that the first 50 were pretty good. It turns out that they were wretched, but The Marvelous Toy was the first song I wrote that I still sing, put it that way. I was at the clerk typer school in the summer of 60, and we had a mandatory 2-hour typing class 4 days a week, and about five or six of us could have passed the final exam on the first day. We'd already learned how to type. I mean, this was a touch typing class, and we were already touch typers, so there isn't anything more boring in the world than learning to type again.
Right.
So, you know, whenever we were doing exercises and stuff like that, I would just skip the exercises and type letters home and stuff like that. And then I started making up poems and stuff like that and a couple of not-so-good songs, and then one day, clicking away on the typewriter, I wrote the words to The Marvelous Toy. It had a slightly different chorus to it. And when I sang it that weekend for Noel Stuckey in the village...
Noel Stuckey is Paul from Peter Paul and Mary.
He made a suggestion about the chorus. He just thought that I could do better with the chorus. And so I forget what the original noises were, but that I came up with zip, bop, and whirr.
Right.
And... I sang it a couple times in the barracks to absolute silence.
Well, yeah.
You know, my fellow trainees were not into children's songs at that point.
I can't
imagine why, but that was the first keeper. Hi, everybody. This is Tom Paxton, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
You were at the Café Wa, so I was also trying to get in the sense of how you already were playing guitar, how you got into the scene of the folk music, even before you wrote Marvelous Toy.
I came into the village every weekend on my army passes and slept on the sofa of a friend of mine from Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and haunted the coffee houses. I met people like Len Chandler. And pretty shortly after that, I met Noel Stuckey and Dave Van Ronk. And,
wow.
And so then, you know, I began to get to do guest sets, three songs, you know, and I never overstayed my welcome. And when I got out, I just stayed there and started working whenever I could.
Were you holding down a job once
again? No, that was my job. I was
excellent. Cool.
Sleeping on sofas and eating hamburgers at coffee houses and getting by that way. And eventually, you know, it started. I moved up and was able to pay half the rent. Stuckey and I lived together for a while.
And I assume this was before he was with Peter
Yarrow. It was while they were putting together Peter, Paul, and Mary and getting ready to do the first album. We were living together. He and Peter Yarrow kept me awake one whole night while they worked on the guitar parts for Lemon Tree, and I've hated this song ever since.
Oh, my gosh. And did they ever help you with any of your songs or co-write any? Or you always wrote
alone? Noel and I co-wrote a couple songs, and to be charitable, they were terrible.
I assume he feels the same way. It would be horrible if he didn't.
We wrote a couple of really sugary nonsense. Oh, awful, awful thing. I don't remember them and don't want to.
Now, at a certain point, you know, a lot of people, or I always thought your first album was Rambling Boy, but no, there was a small album on the Gaslight label. So
somebody
heard you and...
Well, it's to call it the Gaslight label is almost... it's the only album Gaslight Records ever put out. And it was just, you know, privately done by the Gaslight and mostly sold at the Gaslight. And they only pressed like 2,000 copies.
So yeah,
they never did any more pressings of that. So that was the first album I did. I did it live at the Gaslight, and I still have a couple copies of it. It's not bad.
But then you got signed by Elektra.
Yeah.
Because they were going after. I guess they must have come late into the folks scene because Vanguard snapped up a bunch of people, and I guess Warner Brothers.
Yeah, well, it seemed to me at the time as if I was never going to get a contract. I mean, I came to the village in 60, and I got my first Elektra contract in 64. That's a long time to go without, you know, and like everybody was signing here, signing there, but me. And then finally I signed on Elektra, and Jack Holtzman told me we'd go in and do a session, which meant 3 hours, and if anything good came of it, then we'd sign a contract for three albums.
Wow.
And if it didn't work out, in his opinion, then he'd give me the tapes from the session to do with whatever I liked. And luckily, the session went well, and I wound up doing seven albums for them.
Right.
By the way, the last album I did for them was a double LP. Recorded live at the Bitter End, called The Complete Tom Paxton.
Right, that was the one, in fact, where you tell the clerk typist story, as I recall.
Yeah,
and that has
just been released.
Mazel tov.
With six extra tracks that they couldn't squeeze on the LPs. It just came out as a double CD.
By whom?
Yeah.
No, I mean, in other words, is that
I think it's
Rhino?
Only available. I think it's only available on the internet, like at Amazon and stuff like that.
But it's an official release by Elektra, or did Rhino get the rights?
It's Rhino Classic or something like that, which is,
cool.
You know, they were all in the same corporation.
Yeah, no, they were the ones who released Rambling Boy, finally, after... I mean, I have to tell folks that all these Elektra albums that you did have not been available on CD so far as
well,
I know.
Well, they're starting to be now. Elektra UK released the first two LPs as a single CD... And now they've released the third and fourth
albums
of the CD.
Was that Morning Again, and which was...
Morning is the Outward Bound and Morning Again.
Right. And are they going to get around hopefully?
They're available on Amazon. I don't know if they're in the stores or anything.
Well, do you know why it took so many years to get those on disc?
Well, they probably thought there wasn't a lot of money to be made by doing it. And, you know, that tends to pull a lot of weight.
Yeah.
That's all right. I understand. It's kind of a two-edged sword, you know. When they bring out your old stuff, it's competing with your newer stuff, which, of course, you're anxious to see do well and everything. And I can't tell you. I think I had done, like, 14 to 15 albums, you know, and people would come up to me after shows and say, boy, that Ramblin' Boy album, that's my favorite album. You've done like a dozen since then. You say,
what? That was my question about the
Are we talking about my chopped liver albums here or what?
Yeah, no, it's now literally the same theme as that question I asked way back about Last Thing on My Mind. It's like people come up to you after you've written, I don't know, what is it, 500 songs at this point, and they say, oh, Last Thing on My Mind, I love that song. And you've got to be in your head thinking, what about these things on my most recent album? They're wonderful.
Yeah, luckily, people compliment me on the more recent songs, so I don't have to go sulk. Hi, everybody. This is Tom Paxton, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
One thing I have to say, my favorite album of, and I know it is an older one, forgive me for saying that, but I always liked The Things I Notice Now. That was always my favorite. And I remember you reading somewhere that you were never crazy about it. You never liked the arrangements. You thought it was too much strings, too much overdone. Do you still feel that way, or have you heard it recently?
No, I don't. I'm surprised I ever felt that way, but I'm sure I probably said something stupid like that. No, I like that album. That was the first album where I had David Horowitz playing with me on piano, and he did a lot of the arrangements. And Herb Buschler played bass, and then David and Herb played with me a lot over the next 3 or 4 years.
Right. And I should clarify for folks that the first couple of albums were either just playing guitar or guitar and banjo, and then you add a bass, whereas by the time you got to Town Paxton 6... and Things I Notice Now, you really had some full orchestras and some pop orchestrations going, even though it was folk rock.
Yeah.
Was that...
Well, I never called it folk rock. I don't think it didn't really have... It had a fuller sound, but I don't think it was rock.
You still consider it folk or pop?
Yeah,
or
generic folk,
label? Well, let me ask. I guess that brings to the 800-pound gorilla that always sits in the room whenever you talk about folk music. You got your first album in 64, and then you released a couple more, and while that was going on, you know, Bob Dylan was doing his thing.
Uh-huh.
Did you feel pressured as soon as he went electric to have to go in that direction because folk was no longer going to be taken as...
Not at all.
Yeah.
I mean, to paraphrase the title of I guess it was a Reba McEntire song years ago, I was folk before folk was cool. You know, I loved then and love now the sound of an acoustic guitar. And so I was never tempted. You know, I never saw myself fronting some, you know, band with colored lights flashing and all this. I sing folk songs. Even the ones that I write are songs in the folk tradition. So it just never would have worked. I mean, I actually did a concert once at the Village Theater before it became Fillmore East.
Wow.
And I had piano, lead guitar, bass, and I did have a drummer at that gig. And, because we had just been working on some album, I forget. And a terrific reaction. But I was never really tempted because... I mean, you take four pieces out on the road, and you are going to net, you know, 12 cents.
Uh-huh.
I'll never forget, in the middle of about 82, 83, I did an album in Chicago, just myself and David Bromberg, Even the Gray Day. I mean, that was as simple as it gets, and I hadn't seen Dave in a while, and I said, David, we haven't met since the Montreux, Switzerland folk festival of about 77. And, you know, he used to have his big band back then.
Right.
Big band, a lot of people. And he said, oh, yes, that was the year that I grossed $412,000 and netted 19. And so I would never tempt it. I mean, I like to keep it simple.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By and the continuation of my interview with the great Tom Paxton, where last we left off, we were talking about the early years and then him signing a record deal with Elektra. He released 7 albums for them, including the beginning ones, which were just basically guitar and some banjo and a little bit of bass, and then progressively they added more instruments and got a little more ambitious and a little more varied in the style of song that he was doing, and also, of course, the music scene was changing around him, going from folk into rock and roll. So I wanted to pursue that subject of the changing sound of his music and the music around him. In recent years, you've gone back to a much more simple folk sound, but it was opening up towards the mid-60s, at least on the albums, if not in concert. And I was wondering if again, that pop influence came in just so that you could hear different colorations and different instruments.
Well,
on
you
songs.
Know what I like? I love working with Jim Rooney. Jim produced the album I did in 95, I think, called Wearing the Time, and then produced the live album called Live for the Record, which we did here in Alexandria at the Birchmere. And then he produced Looking for the Moon, the newest studio album, which got nominated for a Grammy. So all of those albums were done very simply but very fully. I mean, we always had magnificent players, guitar, dobro, fiddle, mandolin, and bass. And you can get a lot of color from those combinations. And I also like the one that I did with Ann Hills. Ann co-produced that, and that has a lovely sound to it as well.
I'm curious, you have been doing a lot of work with Ann Hills for a bit. Is she a singer in her own right? I had not heard of her except for your albums.
God. Yeah. Oh, you got to get some of her albums. As you could hear on the album we did together, she's one of the best singers in folk music.
And she came from a folk or a country background?
No, folk.
Okay.
Actually, jazz way back, but folk.
Mm-hmm.
She knows a lot of country stuff, plays banjo, guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And the Appleseed album called Best of Friends, which came out not that long ago. Yeah, it's an album of a concert that Ann and the late Bob Gibson and I did in Chicago in 1985. We had a group for a couple of years called Best of Friends, and she's on that, and I just think she's one of the best singers there is, and a great writer, too. Hi, everybody, this is Tom Paxton, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
I'm going to play sort of, I want to say a game. But since we're talking about other people, I would love to hear your thoughts on the careers and songs of some other folks, such as, let's see, we'll start with Tom Waits.
Tom Waits, I haven't heard enough of. I mean, he's kind of under my radar. But what I have heard, I think, is really wonderful. You can always tell a great writer when you hear a song and you can't imagine anyone else having written it.
Yeah, that would be him.
So no, I think he's a very top type of songwriter.
Neil Young.
Neil Young, I like his simplicity. I don't listen much to folk rock or anything like that, but I've never heard anything of his that I didn't like.
Tracy Chapman.
I thought she was terrific, but it really bothered me very, very much that she said about very consciously distancing herself from the folk music community. As soon as she had a hit, she began, you know, she was not calling herself folk or anything. That means she came up through the folk coffee houses and stuff like that. Bothered me, you know. And now and then, interviewers ask me, you know, they say, you know, what do we call you, a singer-songwriter? I said, no, call me a folk singer. I mean, that's what I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she was, and bothered me. But the talent is magnificent.
And what about someone I think who may have stayed a little close? Well, no, not really. She's kind of branched out, but Suzanne Vega.
Oh, wonderful. The vision, the imagination, the artistic courage, I think she's absolutely tops.
Okay, here's kind of a curveball. The Beatles.
Nobody better.
Because why?
Range? I mean, you hear them, you know, when the Beatles wanted to rock and roll, there was no doubt about it. I mean, they were a hell of a rock and roll band. And then they just kept growing and growing and growing, and their lyrics kept getting deeper. And I hear something like Eleanor Rigby, and that's so well crafted. And I use yesterday as a model when I'm teaching songwriting of here is a perfect pop song, which is AABA form. You can't get any better than this. This is it.
And it could be a folk song, too, technically.
Yeah. I'm Rocky Raccoon.
All right. Yeah, I like Rocky Raccoon.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan?
Yeah.
I don't like Bob as much as I used to. I know this is the kind of thing that we hate to hear when we say it, but I prefer his earlier stuff. I thought that Bob got, you know, pretty caught up in the messianic.
Well, that's already about almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I mean, have you Time Out of Mind and some of the more, I mean, he went back and did two folk albums.
Yeah, he's a beautiful writer. And I also have a lot of respect for his commitment to making music. I mean, he's still out there touring. So, you know, I have a lot of respect for Bob. It's just that I haven't felt close to him for a long time.
Well, at a certain point, I mean, not to dwell on it, but you were coming up through the right. Do you have any anecdotes? You must have spoken to him or been on a couple of bills with him or something in the early, or no?
Or me?
Yeah.
Oh, we knew each other. I mean, we were very friendly for a long time. And then, you know, he moved away, I moved away, you know, he did his thing, I did my thing, so I never saw him. I haven't seen him in at least 10 years.
Oh, well, but in the early, I was thinking more in terms of the early 1960s, when...
Oh, yeah, we were perfectly friendly, and we even made up a song one day when we were walking from the village up to 48th Street. He needed to get a harmonica rack or something like that, so we started making up a... very politically incorrect talking blues about Central Park Mugger.
Oh, my gosh.
And we got through about, you know, six verses or something of it, and neither of us ever wrote it down or anything.
And you don't, do you remember anything, a line, under
title? Oh, it was a takeoff on the Talking Union Blues.
Right.
So, I mean, it was, the first verse was pure, just change a word. It was... Oh. You want to be a mugger, tell you what to do, you go to Central Park and you pay your dues. And, I can't remember anything more about it. It was goofy and you know, we were killing ourselves laughing at our own wit and everything, but believe me, it died a merciful death.
Let me ask you, getting away from specific people for a moment. I talked to Neil Sedaka on this program a couple of weeks ago. Great writer in a different vein. And
a very different vein and an absolutely top-to-bottom professional.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't listen to pop music because I only have a certain amount of time where I can listen to anything, so I choose to listen to folk and classic. But I have a lot of respect for people like Neil Sedaka, and a lot of my friends down in Nashville are, you know, absolute hired gun songwriters. They write for the market, and they succeed, and you know, they make a lot more money than I do, and they have a lot of fun, and I cannot do that. I mean, I even tried a couple times to write the way they do, and I can't. But someone like Neil Sedaka, at the Grammys this year, I met Carol King, which was a lot of fun.
Oh, wow.
To meet her. She was... she was getting a Lifetime Achievement Award with her husband, or her ex-husband and writing partner. And I just think that kind of songwriting is so, you know, it's terrific. I mean, they write songs like, you know, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? You know, those songs will always be sung. Just the way, you know, folk songs will be sung. They are their own kind of urban folk songs.
I agree. I absolutely agree. Actually, the reason I brought him up was one of the questions I asked him was about, and he was very honest and interesting in his answer, about he was one of the hottest singer-songwriters, hit makers in America for a couple of years, the whole Brill Building thing.
Yeah.
And then along came the Beatles, and along came the Rolling Stones and the West Coast Sound, and suddenly he found himself, like, the whole jug, he was on top of the mountain, and very quickly they took the rest of the mountain away.
Yeah.
And what do you do, you know, when you have this hot career, and then you've still got to go on with your English, a young man still.
Yeah.
So how did that, I'm not to say that it quite happened in the same way for you, but there you were in the heat of the 1960s, the protest movement, the Vietnam movement, and then 1970 kicked in, and you did the 7 albums for Elektra, and then perhaps America wasn't as interested. You know, it moved towards a different kind of singer-songwriting, like James Taylor.
Yeah.
So what did you do? I mean, did you feel it?
Well,
did you really?
If you're me or a bunch of my friends, you ignore that and you just keep doing what you do. And, I mean, we always found there was enough of an audience there for us to continue to perform and record. And you know, as long as you didn't have any illusions about selling a million records or anything like that. Utah Phillips said very well. He says, you know, you can't get rich in folk music, but you can make a living.
Did you ever meet Woody Guthrie? Did you ever make the pilgrimage?
No,
because we're
no,
in Jersey. And
I grew up 26 miles from his birthplace of Okemah. I lived in a little town in Oklahoma called Bristow.
Mm-hmm.
And I started hearing his songs when I went to the University of Oklahoma. I never knew him while I still lived in was high school or anything like that. And when I came to New York, Woody was already in the hospital, had been in the hospital for some time, and was never going to come out. So once, when Bob first came to New York, I guess it was in 61, he asked me one day if I wanted to go with him to see Woody, because he was going pretty regularly. And I said, no, I just would feel bad about having him have to, you know, have another person see him in that kind of condition. So I passed on it. I've never really regretted that.
He wasn't probably what he had been 20 years earlier.
No, he was in terrible shape. Yeah. You know, he had no control over his limbs. That's it. Years later, I did a public service television thing for the Huntington's Korea Foundation of our association in Massachusetts, and we did it at the hospital with some of the patients, you know, and it was hard to take. It was hard to take. It's a nasty, nasty disease.
Right, and I think Arlo dodged the bullet, and he was worried about getting, because
he had
like a
50-50
shot.
There's some kind of a window that, you know, after a certain age, if you haven't got it, you're not going to get it.
And he's made it through that.
He's made it through that window. I mean, for years there, when he'd get a cold, we all just, you know, panicked. But,
actually, one thing I didn't even ask you yet is, I mean, I asked you about a whole bunch of musical people that I thought are interesting. Who were the folks that you were listening to when you first started to be a songwriter? And who were your
influences? Well, the first one was Burl Ives. I could actually get a hold of some of his recordings, and I loved him. I mean, I started out by learning things like the Blue Tail Fly, you know, and the Streets of Laredo, and you know, the right down the middle of the road kind of homogenized folk songs, you might call them. But I still like those songs a lot.
Sure.
Go Tell Aunt Rhody, you know, things like that. And then when I got to college, I started hearing Woody and Pete, and then and Ed McCurdy, who was one of my favorites, who recorded for Elektra.
Wow.
Then one day I was over at my friend's house. We had a little folk imitation Kingston trio of our own. And he put on an album and said, listen to this. And it turned out to be The Weavers at Carnegie Hall. That was recorded Christmas Eve, 1956.
That must have been mind-blowing.
And, well, it did. I mean, I subsequently had a chance to tell each one of the Weavers, you know, thank you for spoiling my life. because by the end of that side B of that LP, I had undergone a chromosomal change, and I had gone from someone who loved this stuff to someone who had to do it. It was a tremendous. And I'm not the only one. I mean, Peter Yarrow told me he was actually at that concert, and it had the same effect on him. A lot of people of my age, my musical generation, found that album to be one of the most influential albums they ever heard.
The spirit of it, of most of the Weavers albums, but especially a couple of those live ones,
yeah,
is extraordinary.
Not only that, the range of it. I mean, it goes from a children's song, Hush Little Baby Don't Say a Word, to a love song like Kisses Sweeter Than Wine, raucous, you know, When the Saints Go Marching In, songs from the Spanish Civil War, an Indonesian lullaby. Good grief. It was one amazing song after another.